Hello, AJT readers. Welcome to the Editor's Pick podcast for March 2024. I'm your host, Roz Mannin, deputy editor of the Journal. I'm from the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. I'm joined today by two special guests from the editorial board. The first is Dr. Thiago Borges, a faculty member at the Massachusetts General Hospital Transplant Research Institute in Boston, Mass., an editorial board intern. He's also a returnee because he did such a great job the last time. So welcome, Thiago, for coming, helping us out to dissect the basic sciences and do a much better job than I would do. Our second special guest is Associate Editor Dr. Alex Lupi, Professor of Medicine and Nephrology and Director of the Paris Transplant Research Group, known for utilizing large data sets using both supervised and unsupervised analyses, and an innovator in using artificial intelligence kidney transplant, as well as an expert in the Banff allograft pathology classification. Let me go ahead and review the lineup we have today. Our first paper will be presented by Dr. Borges, Transplanting Old Organs Promotes Senescence in Young Recipients, by Jasper Iskay and colleagues. Senior author is Stefan Tullius from the Tullius Lab in Boston. Next, we'll present two papers on the Banff allograft pathology classification from the 2022 meeting. The first is the Banff 2022 meeting report, Reappraisal of Microvascular Information and the Role of Biopsy-Based Transcript Diagnostics, by Nasons and Rufus. Lot of authors on that one. Senior authors are Bob Colvin, Alex Lupi, and Michael Mengel. And the second is the Banff 2022 Kidney Meeting Work Plan, Data-Driven Refinement of the Banff Classification for Renal Allografts. First author is Rufus, co-author is Nasons. Again, very long list of us that participate in the meeting. And senior authors are Colvin, Lupi, and Mengel. And I'll finish up with a couple of interesting papers. The first is Anti-Obesity Pharmacotherapy to Facilitate Living Donation, by Arandi and colleagues at NYU. And the last paper will be Ambient Air Pollution is Associated with Graft Failure and Death in Pediatric Liver Transplant Recipients, by Jared Yelling. Senior authors are Jennifer Lai and Sherrod Wadhani from with a pediatric perspective on transplant outcomes. So without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Borges to talk about senescence and organs.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here again. I'm happy to join you in this March AJT podcast issue. I'm happy to discuss this article by my former colleague, Jasper Iskay, from the Brigham. And they did a very interesting work in how the transplantation of old organs promotes senescence in young recipients. So this is a very interesting paper that they start highlighting how donor age is a significant risk factor for transplant outcomes. However, as they point out, the use of older organs remains critical in addressing sufficient organ supplies. They also point out that the accumulation of senescent cells can compromise transplant outcomes. And they also introduced the concept of senescence-associated secretory phenotype, in which senescent cells produce soluble factors that are capable of inducing a senescent phenotype in the neighboring cells, changing all the microenvironments. The authors of this papers they hypothesized that the transplantation of older organs into young recipients promotes senescence either through the transfer of senescent passenger leukocytes or through the increasing the release of this secretory phenotype. So in terms of methods, they employ several interesting methods in which they transplant a combination of syngeneic old cardiac grafts into young and middle-aged recipients. They did some interesting things in which they measure mitochondrial DNA and these senescence-associated secretory factors to track if the donor cells from these old organs were contributing into this phenotype. They use a P16 GFP reporter mouse strain, which is very elegant. They also, which to me was the coolest part of the paper, they evaluate neurobehavioral and physical functional measurements in the recipients by different methods. And in a set of experiments, they also treat old donors with senolytics, a combination of dasatinib plus quercetin prior to transplantation. In terms of findings, they show that the older hearts, they increase the number of senescent cells in the young recipients. And this was characterized by upregulation of the markers like P21 and P16 30 days post-transplant. Very interestingly, these old isografts, they also impact the physical capacity of the younger recipients, which was they characterized it by this mice fall paw grip strength. And for me, this is very interesting and curious. Besides this impaired physical capacity, they also observed changes in the behavior. The young recipients presented enhanced agitation that the authors related to an increased anxiety. And they also have impaired memory and learning performance. They also point out that this phenotype was not because of metabolic changes. Actually, they suggest this was mediated by muscle intrinsic or neurological dysfunction. In terms of mechanisms, the authors found that the induction of this senescence was not due to the migration of donor senescent cells, as initially hypothesized. It actually correlated with this increase of senescence-associated secretory factors and circulating mitochondrial DNA. To prove that, they did this very cool experiment, which they injected mitochondrial DNA in young mice, and it mimicked the senescent phenotype, including the physical and cognitive dysfunction. So showing that the presence of mitochondrial DNA in the young recipients could, you know, mimic all these changes they observed in the transplant recipients. A translational aspect of this article is that they treated old donors with senolytics prior to the transplantation, and they found that this treatment improved physical capacity of the recipients, which also was very elegant and interesting. Lastly, one thing that the authors did not address, and they acknowledged that, is that whether these effects can last long term. Right. And I think this is a very important question if this concept would be considered and applied in the clinic in the near future.
Well, great summary, Thiago. I had a couple of questions. So it sounds like what they found really is that the driver, I guess, of senescence, they're saying, is really this mitochondrial DNA, which I guess in older folks is circulating because of mitochondrial I hate to use the word degeneration, because you get old, you don't want to feel like you're a degenerate. But it sounds like the release of the systemic release, is it mediates, I guess, an inflammatory innate immune response that propels senescence. So does it matter if it's older cells that are releasing the is it just mitochondrial DNA in general? They did that experiment, does it matter?
I think if I got correctly, they have other publications in this matter. And the hypothesis is that when you have an older organ, this mitochondrial DNA will be more released during the ischemia and reperfusion injury. Okay. Right. Okay. And not only the mitochondrial DNA, but also these other soluble factors that when you place the organ in the recipient, that will somehow change the environment. And then the young recipients will become more senescent.
And I'm fascinated by the behavioral changes.
Yes.
That's a pretty unique finding. There's probably a political election comment I could make about this, but I better not, because, you know, we'll get censored. But it's just fascinating to me that you can actually make the behaviors change based on the aging process and tested in mice. I think your point about the senolytic effect, you know, the long lasting effects of senolytics is helpful. You know, when I've heard some of this group, and particularly Dr. Tullius, presented, I think they initially framed it as sort of a short-term ex vivo, perhaps, treatment or immediate post-operative treatment. But again, your point is well taken. Does that solidify the phenotype of the organ, or are you going to have repetitive aging opportunities? So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think that's still to be addressed, right? And I think that's kind of hard. I don't know how long this mitochondrial DNA will last in the circulation, and I don't know how the methods we have available are good enough to track over time and how long we could track. And I think also in terms of translating this to the clinic, I don't know how the immune suppressive regimens that the patients take also will be modulating all these factors and DNA and, you know, other cytokines and chemokines that are involved. So I think, again, for me, the behavioral part was the coolest part of the paper. And I think maybe that could be measuring the patients easier than the soluble factors, maybe. That also be interesting.
And your point about immunosuppression, I had it as my other third point, is our lab has shown that, you know, constant exposure to calcineurin inhibitors does lead to mitochondrial dysfunction and dramatic changes in cell respiration. And so I wonder if some of this, and we never have really linked our findings, but now we probably, this paper is now making me think, well, we better go and look back at some of our experiments in mice and just sort of look at how that phenotype would change. And again, we never, I mean, I've done this a long time. I've never noticed cognitive changes, but, you know, patients have all this other neurological stuff that they complain about, CNIs, but it does make you wonder if cellular damage in this particular pathway post-transplant may be propelling other issues. Well, great. I appreciate you presenting that.
Thank you. I'm glad to be.
We'll go ahead and move on to the next papers. So now we're going to change topics completely. And next, we'll turn to Dr. Alex Lupi, and we'll hear more about the Banff 2022 meeting and the two papers and the March edition of AJT. So take it away, Dr. Lupi.
Thank you, Rose, and very happy to participate to this podcast for AJT. As you notice, there have been some modification in the Banff classification. 2022 was a classification update, mostly reappraising the lesions of microvascular inflammation and the identification of two phenotypes of cases with microvascular inflammation that are DSA negative and C4D negative. And for cases also with histological lesions of AMR in patients with DSA but without C4D deposits. They are now labeled as probable AMR, so it's a new semantic introduction in the classification, which deserves further studies. And I think it's very important because it addresses at least the gray area and the gray zone where Banff and precision diagnostics have to be. We do not want to overdiagnose AMR, but we do not want to underdiagnose AMR. So I think this gray area on microvascular inflammation needs to be reassessed, and maybe with complementary tools, including molecular diagnostics in the biopsy, new mechanistically informed biomarkers, and also multimodality approaches in diagnostics.
So that's really helpful. I think that the readership often really struggles when we come up with a paper from the change in the meeting and changing criteria. So what I'm hearing from you, Alex, again, is that we're not changing the criteria. We're just highlighting that a subset of individuals that never fit directly into being AMR, three criteria, all that, that the notion that there could be a threshold, you know, you've got DSA or maybe you don't have DSA. And if you have MVI and you don't have either, that this is an area that we're unsure about and certainly not someone to send on their merry way and not see back in the office for a year. And I'm also hearing from you the potential of new phenotypes to identify new therapeutic drugs. And I think that's certainly an important area because we've not been able to get anything approved for AMR treatments of late and of early either. So we're sort of stuck using the same kind of agents. Any thoughts or speculation about the molecular diagnostics? A lot of us don't use them. We don't have access to them. Or if we do, they're just not something we normally use. Are you using them much in Europe?
Yes, Rose, perfectly agree. I think that, you know, Banff established back in 2015 some prototypical situations in which a molecular diagnosis will be warranted to help. And those cases of microvascular inflammation, which do not meet the criteria for being called AMR, I think goes under this category. So we would like molecular diagnosis to apply in some complex cases where there is uncertainty about the diagnosis. And as you mentioned, this is super important for the response to treatment. It's very important for the clinical trials because those criteria needs the molecular dimension to really appraise the underlying biological process that goes on in the graft. You're also right saying that there is no such tool now widely adopted. Banff made a clear move towards a consensus gene set, the BHOT panel, the Banff Human Organ Transplant Panel, and there are a lot of ongoing studies using the FFP approach, which I think is something very useful potentially for clinical implementation. But now we need the context of use. Now we need the proof of clinical utility, meaning that we need to show that it changes outcomes and it changes the way we treat patients. We are not there yet, but maybe the new Banff classification will help into streamlining these situations and maybe adopt at least a path towards collaboration effort towards molecular diagnosis.
And not to just dwell on diagnosis, but the companion paper submitted that's also published by Candace Rufus on the work plan data-driven refinement. Any comments about what, because you were involved in as being the lead for these manuscripts in the meeting organization and consensus development for previous criteria, can you tell us what has changed or what you see as this work plan moving forward?
I think you need to be honest, if we take the big picture, and I think where Banff is kind of stepping in, is we need to address a different component. We need to address diagnosis activity stage, and we need to move into, as we said, precision diagnostics. So really, to my point, the take-home message for this entire initiative, and I think that's what Banff is kind of advocating for, is multimodality approach in diagnosis, the right use of mechanistically informed biomarkers to help to make diagnostic calls and not to overtreat or undertreat patients. And I think last not least, we need some refinement on the way we are applying the classification, because we've seen that there are a lot of complexities, footnotes, and people start not to be, you know, using the classification with a degree of confidence that they can, you know, provide a diagnosis. So automation and how AI also can help us, multimodality approaches in diagnosis, moving from pure histology to histology plus biomarkers plus gene expression, I think is the take-home message from these two papers and will be also what we will be pushing in Paris this September.
Yes, and I'll point out to the readership when they look at the work plan that it highlights all of the unmet needs and questions that each of the Banff working groups is interested in so the public can participate. The only requirement is you actually do work. And that sometimes takes more time than just, you know, being present. But there is a section, again, that I highlight on xenografts, xenotransplant pathology. I think that's an important part and will be an important piece of the pre-Banff transplant meeting in Paris this coming fall. Last but not least, any thoughts about how we did these papers this year? I know you're a co-author, as am I. This was the first year we put them on a preprint server and let the public take their best shot at them. I don't know what your thinking was about it. I mean, I thought it was an interesting approach and had not done that before. So I thought it was kind of interesting to see people pushing back and saying, hey, wait a minute, that's not what I see. I didn't come to the meeting, but I read this. This is what my clinical thoughts are.
No, Rose, perfectly agree. And I think that was also pushed by Michael Mengel and Sandy Feng, the editor-in-chief of AJT. From my understanding and what I've seen, the process went very smoothly. I think we were able to engage beyond the Banff community and people who could not attend the Congress. Actually, we had some exchanges with them. We also promoted not only the online and the preprint platform, but also some questionnaires and Delphi surveys around participants, among participants. So I think, you know, that's part of the evolution of Banff. And I think from the editorial and the journal perspective, because we want these results to be disseminated, we want these results to be criticized, discussed. And I think that's the way we can reach a better consensus. And that's what Banff tries to achieve. I mean, we do the best as we can. It's not perfect, but I think we are on the right track to improve things.
Well, thanks. I'll call you Alex, but to the audience, you're Dr. Loopy. So thanks for spending this few minutes with us. I'm going to turn and shift gears again to two other papers that are unrelated to Banff, but are important clinical topics.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you, AJT. And we look forward to seeing you in Paris in September. Registration will open. The program will be amazing. And we are happy to push the Banff journey to Paris.
All right. Well, let me get going. And our last two papers are kind of interesting and diverse. The first paper I'll be presenting is Anti-Obesity Pharmacotherapy to Facilitate Live Donation by Arandi Laughlin, Montgomery, and Segev from NYU. This is a personal viewpoint, and this paper describes the potential impact of treating obesity on live donation and how, and really sort of reflects and exposes and reviews some of the practices that we use for obesity management. Importantly, in 2001, almost 62% of live donors were considered obese or overweight, and this has increased in 2016 to about 66% are classified as obese or overweight, with nearly 45% that have BMIs greater than 30. And we know that there is a risk of obesity in live kidney donation, granted that the absolute risk of these complications is small, but the relative risk is quite high, and they include hypertension, almost a twofold increase in chronic kidney disease, and an increased risk of death. And hence, there is a lot of management of obese donors now or turning away of potential living donors unless they reach a certain weight. And this paper explores potential strategies and makes several points. I think it's important to note that the authors identify obesity as a chronic relapsing disease, not gluttony per se, and people just not taking care of themselves, that no matter what treatment is successful in weight loss, whether it's diet, exercise, or medications, that once those interventions are stopped, that there can be relapse, and that weight gain is common after live donation. And they reminded me of some older data that has been published by Arthur Matus and colleagues, where there is significant weight gain, and they estimated that a greater than or equal to 5% total body weight gain post-living donation increases your risk for hypertension by 83%. So the manuscript really talks about several points. One is, you know, is there an impact of treatments pre-donation on post-donation outcomes? And there are a lot of unmet needs in this area and a lot of questions, particularly what is a safe threshold BMI for which you can move forward with these patients? And I don't think that's really been very well studied. And that's in table one of this paper. And then table two reviews the potential medications or supplements that donors can be on that may be obesogenic or pro-obese. And so it's important then when we're seeing living donors, if the only reason we're not going to use a living donor is because we're concerned about their obesity, to really sit down with them and look over these things. And they also review the interventions that are available, all of them, diet, exercise, potential for bariatrics and medications. And I think this is really helpful because not everybody has a dietitian and a pharmacist that may be dedicated to work with them. And some of the things I learned in this paper is, you know, the association, I've heard of this, but really nice data presented about ultra processed foods and higher caloric intake and weight gain. So they taste good, but they make you gain more weight. They talk about intermittent dieting and those energy restrictive things, the whether it's the daily fast or intermittent feeding, are really not superior to just sort of standard caloric weight loss. And then also some of these other fads like high protein diets, where greater than 20% of your intake is protein content. And there's some significant negative consequences, though you may lose weight, but developing osteoporosis and stone formation, as well as kidney damage. They review the exercise guidelines and recommendations for moderate intensity and then higher intensity, really reminding the reader that when you get someone to lose weight and they've been doing greater than or equal to 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise a week, they actually have to go up on that. And again, not really explored here are some of the metabolic and resets that occur in obesity where you can get down to a weight. And if you're really restricting, you can have a change set point and you have to really increase your activity. And they mention that. They also review a lot of the medications, some of which I've always been trying to lose weight and I've been more successful sometimes than others. The table three really reviews some of these meds and the data relative to using metformin, topiramate, naltrexone with bupropion combinations, and then, of course, GLP-1 agonists. So certainly GLP-1 agonists have had the most dramatic effects on weight loss and seen across the country. It's in every magazine, every newspaper, every commercial. And many of you are probably aware of in your community of these freestanding clinics, whether it's women's hormonal health or men's hormonal health, where they're actually providing these prescriptions for these agents. And it's pointed out that just based on obesity alone, that there is not approved insurance coverage. And so when screening patients and putting them on these medications, if that's the tack that's taken, it's not covered by insurance. And so, again, for those that have access and have finances and want to be a live donor, that may be an opportunity, but we have to be cognizant that not all living donors come from a socioeconomic status where these drugs can cost about $1,000 a month. They end the paper talking about ethics and policy consideration, that these treatments, though we might get a donor down to weight, and I hate using that expression, but I see it creeping into our language almost like a wrestling team wrestler trying to get down a weight to make a tournament, and then they gain the weight back, and then they're in this yo-yo. But, you know, this is lifelong treatment. And so I always try to emphasize to my living donors that a healthy lifestyle, you know, paying attention, because 20 years from now, I'm not going to be their doctor. And so creating habits that are long lasting and good, you know, 5% weight loss of total body weight can really significantly improve glycemic control and and blood pressure in many individuals. In fact, patients with borderline hypertension that may be on a blood pressure medicine may not need it, and can significantly affect cardiac and renal outcomes long term. But clearly, we need more study to understand the impact of our strategies now. I would say that since probably 2021, you know, 2020 was a down year because of COVID, but I see a lot more patients, you know, donors coming in, and we're accepting them at a higher BMI, and they're already on agents because they went to their primary care doctor and sort of figured out that they would feel better if they could lose some weight. So I think that's a great paper with more to come, and really would suggest you take a look at, especially if you're involved in living donation. My last paper is by Jared Yowling and colleagues. The vast majority are from UCSF. Ambient air pollution is associated with graft failure and death in pediatric liver transplant patients. So in a prior podcast, I think back in 2021, we highlighted that small particulate pollution, this is particle, a PM 2.5 or smaller, these fine particulates associated that are measured in the air, was associated in adult kidney transplant recipients with higher rates of delayed graft function, acute rejection, and an increased risk of mortality. And that came from Dori Segev's group. And we also know that these PM 2.5s are associated with other poor health outcomes and are often concentrated in neighborhoods with high traffic density and or location of factories and uncontrolled pollution. So this study examines the relationship of these pollutants and specifically in outcomes in pediatric liver transplant recipients. So this group examined a cohort through the scientific registry, the SRTR, of all PEDS transplant recipients from 2005 and 2015. In that 20-year period, they used zip codes that were present at the time of transplant and data from the Center for Air, Climate, and Energy Solutions, CACES, that have developed a model from the EPA monitoring and utilizing data on PM 2.5 content. Note that about 0.3% of individuals were excluded from the study because of a lack of zip code entry in their data forms. The primary outcome was a composite of death, graft failure at 10 years post-transplant. And a lot of, they developed sort of an interesting way of doing their covariates using causal inference and a directed acyclic graft conceptualization. So here, race was viewed as a social construct, not a medical construct, and as a proxy for the health effects of racism. So in their model, race included in multivariate models was a proxy for socioeconomic status, neighborhood choice, social deprivation, rurality, and the lack or the type of insurance coverage. So they in their total cohort, they ended up with about 4,200 children. 16% have resided in high particle 2.5 neighborhoods. And those kids were most likely to be of Black race, living in urban areas and in socioeconomically deprived areas with higher MELD and PELD scores at the time of transplantation. Interestingly, while one-year outcomes based on classification of PM 2.5, whether it was low or high, there really were no differences. The differences became apparent at both 5 and 10 years, where 5-year graft failure rates and survival fell from 75% as high, it was 83% in terms of survival in the low group. I'm saying this terribly. What I meant to say is in the high group, survival rates were lower, 75% compared to the 83% in the low group. And at 10 years, this disparity widened with a graft survival rate of only 71% compared to 81% in low PM2.5. I'm not going to get into all the detailed analyses. They're in the paper. They had a lot of findings through univariate analysis, but I would say it was the multivariate model that adjusted for neighborhood socioeconomic deprivation and rurality that was associated with a 53% increase in hazard ratio for graft failure and death. And so I think that this is demonstrates really sort of an independent association that air pollution is associated with graft failure and death in pediatric liver transplant recipients. And I think you can say this is pediatric and okay, does it stop there? No, probably it does affect the other organs as well in these kids, but also the association in older adults. The mechanism isn't clear. Obviously, as scientists, we always say, well, there's an association. What's the mechanism? And certainly these fine particulates can create inflammation, both, you know, pulmonary inflammation, but eventually can lead to systemic inflammation and innate immune responses that may be what is associated with chronic inflammation, particularly in kids where you can get sort of accelerated pictures of other chronic diseases. It does suggest that there could be ways to mitigate their outcomes by perhaps avoiding smoking or using air purifiers. But again, in areas of social deprivation, what's going to be the access to these devices? And maybe smoking is more frequent, but even so, the structural mitigation, I think, will be quite difficult. I think schools and daycares are located in hubs of areas of high traffic and accessibility. So again, it's a very thought-provoking paper. There are limitations, taking this population-based data and saying that this is an individual patient outcome. That could be considered what they call ecological fallacy. I think the zip code at the time of transplant may not be the zip code that a child may reside in as they grow older, as they age out of being a pediatric patient, because this study included children under the age of 18. So if you were 17 in 10 years, you may not be living in the same neighborhood near your family. And I think that zip codes really vary. So again, the thought about a zip code is it's an area that makes it easy for the post office to deliver your mail. And some zip codes really cross over different types of spaces that are maybe not entirely accurate of a specific location. And so while we say, oh, that zip code's in a bad part of town, the bad part of town may include the good part of town. And so there may have been some bias in terms of how these neighborhoods were aligned. There are probably other unmeasured confounders that exist here. But I think, you know, defining more precisely these mechanisms and understanding this management is really, I think, sort of the critical part of this paper. Well, gentlemen, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate you returning. And hopefully we will not have you, Thiago, on another podcast. But again, appreciate it and appreciate your contributions today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The opinions of the hosts of the show do not necessarily reflect those of the American Journal of Transplantation. For AJT highlights, you can find us online at amjtransplant.com. That's amjtransplant.com. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter.